This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Throughout this year, we have shared the story of Ed Johnson, an African-American man who was lynched on Chattanooga's Walnut Street Bridge in 1906. On Sunday, September 19th, the Ed Johnson Memorial will be dedicated near that bridge. Journalist Peter Canellos, a current editor at Politico and a former editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, recently wrote a book about a key legal figure in the Ed Johnson case, Justice John Marshall Harlan of the United States Supreme Court. Peter's book, titled The Great Dissenter, The Story of John Marshall Harlan, America's Judicial Hero, tells how a former slave owner, with the help of a once enslaved man who grew up alongside him and who was believed to be his half-brother, changed American law. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What drew you to the story of Justice John Marshall Harlan?
Well, I went to law school in the late 1980s, and reading cases, which can often be a very, you know, dry exercise, almost a purposely dry exercise, you know, Harlan's dissents kind of leaped off the page to me. This is especially true in the race cases. I mean, he was known as the Great Dissenter, and he really created an entire body of jurisprudence in two areas, one in sort of battling some of the court's efforts to prevent the government from grappling with the inequality during the Gilded Age, which I think was a very noble set of dissents that helped to set the stage for future reforms in the law. But he also is most famous for being the sole dissenter in case after case involving African Americans at a time when the Supreme Court was taking away the rights of African Americans. So I found him an extraordinary figure. I later learned when I was the Boston Globe, Washington Bureau Chief, and we were covering Supreme Court nominations in 2005. We had an old legal encyclopedia, and I ended up reading an entry on Harlan and read for the first time about Robert Harlan, who had been presumed to be his half-brother in his lifetime, and who had an amazing career as an African-American leader, becoming the leading politician, Black politician in Ohio. And I sort of thought, well, I'd been curious for so long about how somebody like Harlan could stake out very different opinions from his colleagues and often being the lone dissenter and yet find himself totally in the mainstream of the future. You know, he was somebody who was amazing in his prescience. And where a lot of that was on racial issues, you think, well, his relationship with Robert Harlan, which continued into their adulthood, must have played a role. So that sort of set the stage for exploring the question of how Harlan saw the law differently than his colleagues and saw the law in a way that we now approve of. You know, now the law is Harlan's law. It's not the law of the court majority during the Gilded Age. So he's an extraordinary figure and it's an extraordinary story. And that certainly is what drew me to it.
He came from Kentucky, and leading up to the Civil War, he favored compromise almost at all costs to preserve the Union. And because compromise at all costs was no longer an option, resulting in the Civil War, that helps to explain why, once he was on the court beyond the Civil War, we talk about Reconstruction into the Gilded Age, he was so vociferous in his dissents for African Americans.
I think that's right. I think that he saw the limits of compromise. I think, you know, if he were here today, he would say he was in a very different role when he was on the court as opposed to when he was in politics. And he would probably defend the idea that if you are sitting in Kentucky, not that far from Tennessee, you're right in the middle and you can see the states' rights arguments brewing all around you in the South. And you can see the demand for abolition growing in the North and anger at Southern intransigence. And you fear that your state is going to be the battleground. And in Harlan's case, he knew that Kentucky was very much divided, sort of 50-50 between Northern and Southern sympathies, and sensed that it would destroy the civic fabric as well of Kentucky. So I think he would have said the compromises were noble efforts to try to forestall an apocalyptic disaster, as he viewed it. But the fact that those compromises didn't work led him to believe that the great sin that caused the Civil War was inequality. And in this very prominent way, slavery put inequality under the law front and center in the country's political debates. And when the Supreme Court ruled in Dred Scott that African Americans have no rights, that white people need respect, even when they are free and not enslaved, he felt like the Supreme Court had put slavery and inequality into the U.S. Constitution. So he dedicated his life as a Supreme Court justice from 1877 until he died in 1911. He really dedicated himself to promoting the importance, the significance of safeguarding equality under the law. And that took several forms. It took the form of fighting segregation. So Plessy v. Ferguson, he had this famous dissent that we still quote today, saying with all these memorable lines like Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. The humblest is the peer of the most powerful. There is no caste here. You know, these are sort of iconic Harlan statements warning the country of the tremendous cost of inequality under the law, as approved by the Supreme Court, ruefully approved by his colleagues in Plessy v. Ferguson. He also fought against inequality in cases where the United States took over supervision of protectorates and took on what were essentially colonies in the Philippines, Hawaii, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. Congress was running these places out of their back pocket, essentially, and making up the rules as they were going along. And he was the one who said that, look, if people in those places are living under the U.S. Constitution, in this country, the Constitution is sovereign and they deserve equal rights and equal protection. I think that in those cases, he saw sort of a restoration of what had led to the Civil War, you know, imagining this giant system of colonies the United States could have, where you have all these people, predominantly non-white people, you know, living under systems of very limited rights, and then a large number of people in the continental United States, mostly white people, living under the Constitution. It was untenable in his view. So that's how he came to be the father of equal protection under the law.
He also showed a sense of symbolism with his dissents. I'm thinking of a certain inkwell that he used.
Absolutely. That's a great story. He first became the great dissenter in 1883. He had been on the Supreme Court for 6 years and had been very much sort of the junior justice, very go along, get along. It was very hard to discern exactly what his priorities were on the court. And then everything changed in 1883. This was by far the biggest case that came before the court up to that time in his tenure. It was called the Civil Rights Cases of 1883. It embraced a number of different disputes in places all around the country, north and south, where Black people had been guaranteed under a law passed by Congress access to transportation, to inns, to restaurants, to theaters. And yet individual business owners in these areas were systematically excluding them. So these cases come before the Supreme Court, and this is kind of an epic case. This is the kind of thing that everybody in the country in 1883 was aware of. People in the South did not want to have to, you know, serve Black people at their lunch counters. White people felt that way. A lot of white people felt that way. And they felt like it was a terrible thing that Congress was forcing them to do so. Same was viewed by some people in the North as well. But among African Americans and their supporters, still a fairly significant group of people, one white allies, this was kind of the whole ballgame. And the Supreme Court, made up of all Northerners as well as Harlan as the sole Southerner, considered this. You know, they spent a lot of time debating this case. And all of the Northerners essentially decided to coalesce around a theory that the post-Civil War amendments, which were specifically designed to protect African-American rights, could only apply to explicit racist acts by a state legislature, that they defined state action so narrowly that unless a state came out and said, we are discriminating against African-Americans in a law, as opposed to allowing people in businesses and other places to exclude Blacks, that it was going to be okay. And the justices obviously wanted unanimity in this case. And here was Harlan, the junior member among them, understanding in his bones that this was a mistake, that this was a terrible turning point for the country. He knew, I think, instantly that he wanted dissent to this. But he also knew that he had to write a dissent that would stand for the ages, and he needed to justify to the entire country why he felt this was wrong. And it was a tremendous challenge, not just in terms of casting it in the proper sort of moral light about what a terrible wrong was being done to African Americans, but also in explaining his own different interpretation of the post-Civil War amendment, interpretations that going forward would protect Black rights. He was struggling with this. He was sitting in his study agonizing over this opinion. And his wife remembered something that he had done years earlier. He had tried to collect little keepsakes from American history. And one of them was an inkwell that Chief Justice Roger Taney, who was not somebody Harlan or his family had supported, but he was the author of the Dred Scott decision, which in Harlan's view had like put the country on the path to civil war, a terrible decision, the worst decision in Supreme Court history, but a monumental one. You know, Roger Taney had used this inkwell to write the decision. So there's Harlan agonizing over his opinion, sitting up there in his study, and his wife quietly comes to him and puts what he instantly recognizes as Roger Taney's inkwell next to him. And she said that, you know, from that moment on, this opinion flowed beautifully out of his pen because he knew what the stakes were. He knew that the Supreme Court had the power to take away rights and the Supreme Court had the power to grant rights. And in this case, he wanted to stand up for the rights of people.
We're speaking with Peter Canellos, author of The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero.
That was 1883. You have also talked about 1896 and Plessy versus Ferguson. Let's go to 1906, the case of Ed Johnson here in Chattanooga. Walk us through how Justice Harlan intervened.
Well, Justice Harlan, like all Supreme Court justices, was assigned a particular federal circuit that consisted of several states. And the Sixth Circuit at that time included Kentucky and Tennessee, his home state, and he was senior enough that he was able to get that assignment. What it meant was when people brought urgent emergency appeals to the Supreme Court, they would have that one justice review it because it was impractical time-wise to get all the justices together to consider the case. So you had this manifest injustice in Chattanooga where Ed Johnson, a Black man, had been tried and convicted of raping a white woman, even though there were what we will now acknowledge were terrible problems with the case. It was conducted in an extreme prejudicial environment. The judge himself had promised a mob that he would put this case at the top of the docket. There were intimidating characters all around in Chattanooga. There were mistakes at trial. So at one instance in trial, when the victim declined to make a positive total identification of Ed Johnson, being berated on the stand, like, can you say under God that this is the man who attacked you? And she couldn't. And she started weeping. And this man in the jury box, you know, starts shouting, you know, I would kill him now if I can get to him. Well, obviously, the judge should have excused that juror for that, you know, moment of explosive emotion, but it never happened. And Johnson was convicted on the most slender evidence. And his attorneys, his court-appointed attorneys, some of whom were white, didn't even see the point of going to the Supreme Court because for years, state courts had been using very shoddy procedures to convict people, a lot of them African-Americans, some of them whites, but violating core protections in the U.S. Constitution. And the Supreme Court, I think in the same spirit of sort of not wanting to rock the boat, had never asserted itself. Another issue was that there was never any enforcement mechanism. They sort of knew that these state officials would just ignore what the court did. So it seemed like a hopeless case, but Noah Pardon, who was a young African-American attorney, saw the injustice in this, got on a train, went up to Washington almost immediately after Ed Johnson was sentenced to death, finds a more senior African-American attorney in Washington who knows his way around the city a little bit and gets him to help him out. The two of them go to Harlan's house, knock on the door, you know, here's our petition, you're overseeing the Sixth Circuit. Had a meeting with him, discussed the case. And Harlan, who I think obviously took a very, very different view of the danger, not just to African-Americans, but to the entire American system of allowing these sort of segregation era injustices to occur, he saw an opportunity to do something about it. So he ordered a Supreme Court review and ordered the execution stayed. And then, as we know, there was such outrage among the white officials in Chattanooga, and there was such passion, and there had already been mobs massing at the jailhouse, that the sheriff left the jail unguarded and essentially abetted a lynching that was the crime of the century in Chattanooga and beyond. Then Harlan stepped in and arranged to meet with his judicial colleagues to say that this was a blatant act of disrespect and contempt for the Supreme Court, and something had to be done. And the justices, the Supreme Court had never sat as a trial court. It's always an appeals court. It's always just reviewing cases. But for the first time in its history, at Harlan's instigation, the court sat as a trial court and got the cooperation of President Theodore Roosevelt and the Attorney General, William Moody, at the time. It was an amazing situation. I mean, there was no FBI then, so they had to take two people from the crew that was guarding Theodore Roosevelt and the Secret Service and just send them down to Chattanooga to do fact-finding and research. And that led to indictments of Sheriff Shipp, who was really one of the leading, if not the leading politician in that era, a Confederate veteran, a man so proud of his Confederate past that he would sort of walk around town in his Confederate uniform. This was 40 years later. He played a role in creating a battlefield park and sort of a memorial on Lookout Mountain and things. So he's a real leader in the community. But in this case, he had clearly abetted a terrible crime. So the court convicted him. The Supreme Court convicted him. It was a 6-month sentence. He returned to Chattanooga to a hero's welcome with his supporters, went on to continue to celebrate the Confederacy the rest of his life. Nonetheless, the precedent had kind of been laid down that the court was not going to tolerate this from local officials. So Harlan's actions, both in ordering the review of the case and then in ordering that the officials be held accountable, was very, very significant in sending a strong message to the South and elsewhere that legal procedures needed to be followed and that these outrageous acts of racism would never be tolerated.
And that criminal trial was not only the first time for the Supreme Court, but the only time in its history.
The only time. Yes, absolutely. And that's why, you know, there are constitutional law professors out there that don't talk about the Shipp case because it isn't a precedent in a traditional Supreme Court way. When you're studying constitutional law, cases grow out of one another. And if a case has been decided and is good law, it provides a precedent for the future. In the Shipp case, it was strictly a criminal trial. You know, the decision was Sheriff Shipp and a couple of mob leaders were guilty and punished, but it didn't make it into the constitutional law books because it wasn't that kind of a precedent. And so a lot of people who know the law and who followed Harlan's career and other things are totally unaware of the Shipp case. So it's a unique moment in Supreme Court history. There's a lot of evidence that it was noticed in the African-American community, but like a lot of the decisions that came down in the court by that time, you know, the white community had sort of inured itself a little bit to the idea that Black rights weren't going to be respected in this society. And so it was in the Black community that these incidents like the Shipp case, but also like Harlan's dissents in Plessy v. Ferguson and other things were really studied and came to be important in sort of keeping the flame of hope alive until people like Thurgood Marshall and Constance Baker Motley and James Neighbor and the other great African-American civil rights leaders, civil rights lawyers of the mid-20th century were able to really persuade the court to change its stance.
And yet that outcome reverberated down through the generations. When you get to the 1950s and the 1960s, and the Supreme Court hands down Brown versus Board of Education, and you have all of these legal challenges through the federal courts in the South. I'm thinking George Wallace in front of the schoolhouse door and on and on and on. The pushback to the Supreme Court never went back to how the court was treated when Justice Harlan intervened in the Ed Johnson case, Johnson was lynched, and then the court conducted its only criminal trial.
I think that's an important point, Ray, that others, Judge Curtis Collier in Chattanooga has made this point, that it sort of laid down a marker. It sort of told local elected officials that they cannot defy the Supreme Court. And that was remembered, and it was a show of will. And so when, you know, 50 years later, as you were saying, George Wallace is standing in front of the school door and everything like that, there was a sense that the local officials would bluster a lot, but they would not actually defy the Supreme Court, knowing that they themselves would be potentially convicted for contempt of court.
And they would also delay a lot, which prompted the Supreme Court to issue a further decision after Brown versus Board of Education, implement this with all deliberate speed.
Yeah, I love that phrase, all deliberate speed. It's like you can apply it in a lot of ways. Like, when are you doing your homework, son, with all deliberate speed? You know, it's like, what does that mean exactly? But, you know, unfortunately, we're still implementing Brown versus Board of Education. So the deliberate speed has not gone fast enough for a lot of people.
Peter Canellos is with us. He is the author of The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero.
What lessons do you think the life and career of Justice Harlan have for right here, right now, not only for this country, our country, but here in Chattanooga as we prepare to observe the dedication of the Ed Johnson Memorial?
Well, I think what Chattanooga has done in coming together to embrace the cause of the memorial, to really seek to understand Ed Johnson's terrible sacrifice, to really look at something that is so painful and so gruesome and so much a part of its past, is an extraordinary model for other communities. Chattanooga is not the only community that had terrible atrocities happen in its midst. I've interviewed LeFrederick Thurkill, I'm sure you have, and other people have. You know, tells a story of how even in his childhood, there were people in the Black community who were not going to go on the bridge. It was a bad bridge. It was not passable. And yet nobody on either side of the racial divide wanted to even talk about this case. It just was completely forgotten. It was too painful in the Black community and tragic and horrible. And in the white community, it became an embarrassing secret, almost like a family secret, that nobody wanted to talk about this terrible thing that had happened. And now Chattanooga is talking about it and people have come together. And I have been to Chattanooga, interviewed all the key people in the Ed Johnson Project, and more recently have become apprised of the work that you have done, that documentary filmmakers have done, that other people in the community have done to try to draw attention to this. And it's a tremendous model for other communities. Well, how did it come about? I think it came about because that Supreme Court record existed. And that is something you can directly trace to John Marshall Harlan. If it weren't for Harlan, there would be no record of what happened. And when you think about some of the other tremendous atrocities and terrible lynchings and things like that occurred, a lot of them were by masked marauders, Ku Klux Klanners, and the so-called good people of town could easily look the other way and say, not us, these were the ruffians that did it. You know, we don't really believe in violence. We don't really support this. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court record in the Ed Johnson case showed that many different sort of stations of authority within the town endorsed what happened or played a role in sort of firing people up. And that includes my own profession, journalism, our own profession. It includes ministers who preached against the Supreme Court intervention. It certainly includes elected officials like Sheriff Shipp and members of the legal system like Judge McReynolds, who had overseen that case. So there's no debate about what happened in Chattanooga. There's no trying to find who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, what was the real deal here, are people being wrongly accused, that kind of thing. It was all settled. It was, facts had been found. And I think it demonstrates that when there is a clear consensus of facts and when there is a real record, instead of fighting and dividing communities, people can come together in a spirit of common understanding and try to make sense of these things. So when you think of Chattanooga going forward with this memorial right there at the base of the bridge on the Chattanooga side, you know, what in many ways was the heart of the community and is still the heart of the city, it's a show of confidence by Chattanooga to acknowledge that and to say, look, we're not looking the other way. We're talking about this. We're acknowledging this. We're honoring the spirit of Ed Johnson, who said, God bless you all, as he's dying on the bridge, the victim of a lynch mob. And I think that speaks well for Chattanooga today and portends well for Chattanooga in the future.
All right. Peter Canellos, thank you so much for your time here. Thank you for telling the story of Justice John Marshall Harlan, and we look forward to seeing you at the dedication.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ray.
Peter Canellos, author of The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero, published by Simon & Schuster. For more information about the dedication of the Ed Johnson Memorial here in Chattanooga on Sunday, September 19th, visit edjohnsonproject.com. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. The Sequoia Birthplace Museum in Vonore is the only tribally owned museum in Tennessee. On Saturday and Sunday, the museum, along Teleco Lake in the Great Smoky Mountains, will host its 30th annual Cherokee Fall Festival. Charlie Rodarmer is manager and director of the museum, owned and operated by the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us more about the festival.
It's the Cherokee Fall Festival at Sequoia Birthplace Museum, and this is our 30th year, and it's also the bicentennial of Sequoia finishing the syllabary. The Cherokee, up until this point, had a spoken language, but they had no way to write anything down, no numbering system. And Sequoia actually developed a numbering system in his blacksmith shop to use as an accounting system to keep records of who owed him what for the work that he did. And then it was in 1809, in his blacksmith shop, he announced to a group of Cherokees, hey, we could create a writing system. And so he began in 1809 and spent 12 years trying to create a writing system, which he finally finished in 1821 with a syllabary. So it's not an alphabet, it's a syllabary. It's the sounds of the language have symbols.
And to the extent that the Cherokee language survives to this day is because of that.
Majority of Cherokees that speak, some don't read still today, but there are a number of folks that are speakers and readers. One of the concerns is that a lot of those folks are getting up in age, and also because of our times, a lot of those speakers, we're losing them.
And how will the festival proceed this year, given these milestones and also given the pandemic that we're still living with?
We're owned and operated by the Eastern Band of the Cherokee, and so we follow their mandates to what the tribe does. And so we've implemented wearing masks in the building, social distancing, hand sanitizer, you know, at the doors. So that'll be maintained through the festival. We just had a balloon festival this past weekend, and there was a few people that didn't like the mask, but, you know, that was the policy of the Eastern Band. So, and then outside is just socially distancing, and once again, sanitizer and things like that will be available.
For people who are not familiar with the museum, tell us more about that.
Sequoia Birthplace Museum was created as a result of the Teleco Lake. When TVA started building the lake, and then the environmentalists found the snail darter and said, oh, you can't build this lake because it'll cause the snail darter to go extinct. Well, the environmentalists were protesting, but so were the Cherokee. And a lot of the national media, they focused on the snail darter and not the Cherokee. And when I think it was Jimmy Carter finally signed a bill into law that was said, you'll ignore all federal laws, you'll finish the dam, close the floodgates. And when they realized that the environmentalists had lost, the Cherokees realized there was no way of stopping it. And so they went to the Tennessee Valley Authority and said, how will you commemorate and remember the Cherokee people that lived here in the Cherokee Overhill? And so the Sequoia Birthplace Museum, as a result of that, we have a memorial mound, which one of the first ideas for them to commemorate was to return the remains of the Cherokee that could be identified as 18th century Cherokee. And 192 were returned back to the Eastern Band and reburied, and there's a memorial mound there on our grounds. And that actually set the precedent for what was going to happen in the 1990s with NAGPRA, which is the Native American Repatriation Act that gives the right to all federally recognized tribes and nations the right to go get their ancestors, religious artifacts, burial items back from government institutions, museums, universities. And so that kind of is a result of something that happened there in the Cherokee Overhill.
How long have you been involved with the museum?
I volunteered a couple of times back in the 90s, but I came to Sequoia in 2000 and never left. It's a nice place to be.
How have you seen things change with the museum and its presence here in East Tennessee in that time?
When I got there back in the 90s and up until about 2000, the museum was struggling to stay open. And that's one of the things a couple of granting institutions says, we need to see that it's sustainable. And I'm like, look, this place has been sustainable. The only thing that's finally shut us down was 2 months last year because of the COVID. The board members back in the 90s and the 80s, they were able to do what needed to be done to keep the doors open. Fundraisers, some of them went in and kept it open. And so the museums never actually closed due to finances. But back in 2000, it was counting every penny. And as time has gone by, we've done more programs and found more grant resources and income resources for the museum. And so we're doing much, much better now. So we were able to renovate the museum starting, I guess, about 4 years ago and got reopened about 3 years ago. So it's a brand new exhibit focused on Sequoia and what he did and his great accomplishment.
These are all signs of a greater appreciation and interest in the Cherokee story and how that story is a thread that weaves through the history of this region.
True. One of the things you'll hear is I hear a lot is my Cherokee grandmother, great-grandmother. And typically, I think that goes back to one of the things is the removal, because if you were a Cherokee married to a white man, you stayed. If you were a white woman married to a Cherokee man, you went, you were removed. And so I think that's where everybody gets their great-grandmother was Cherokee. It's actually probably a great-great-great-grandmother.
What are some of the things that the festival will offer this time around?
Due to the current situation, we've had a couple of our educators and entertainers that we've lost. And so we've actually talked with several of the others. We have the Warriors of Anagadua. They're the ambassadors of the Eastern Band. They will be dancing and performing different Cherokee dances. And then several of them will be set up and we'll have a living history timeline of people talking about pre-contact Cherokee or the 18th century and the 19th century. And so we'll have a number of people, a number of the Cherokees will actually be talking about and demonstrating basketry and pottery, finger weaving, carving. And so you'll be able to actually talk and ask questions and interact. As you kind of park and you come in, that's the first line you see is kind of some summer houses with the Cherokee demonstrating and talking to folks about their culture and their history. And then the festival area, we've got most all of our vendors are coming. I think we have about 26, I think, somewhere in there. And so they focus on arts and crafts, some Cherokee vendors. So there's a number of different things. We've had knife makers in the past. I'm not sure if he's coming back. And so we have Nikki's Fry Bread. She's Cherokee. And if you haven't had an Indian taco, that's something you need to experience.
And there's also going to be a reenactment.
The Eastern Band of the Cherokee joined the Confederate Army. And Will Thomas, who had actually been down outside of Cherokee, the area of Cherokee, and when he got back and found out that they had pledged to join the Confederate Army, and the Confederacy said, well, we're going to send you down the coast of South Carolina, and you'll be patrolling down there. And it's like Thomas then went to the Confederate powers that be and said, these people are mountain people. They know nothing of swamps. And so he ended up starting what was called the Thomas's Legion. And a legion has infantry, cavalry, and artillery. And so there were probably, around 400 Cherokee that served four companies in Thomas's Legion. As I mentioned, they were raised there in North Carolina. They actually spent the majority of the war here in Tennessee. Their first battle was up at Baptist Gap, just a gap over from Cumberland. Then their last battle here late in the war was a running battle from Sevierville to Gatlinburg. And then they finally retreated back over in the mountains towards western North Carolina and stayed. There was actually a battle probably 3 miles from the museum called Motley Ford, which was originally the Motley town. And as the locals kind of shortened it to Motley. And there was a battle that took place there, and a number of the Cherokee were killed. A few of the Cherokees were killed there at that battle. And so we reenact that. And so we have some Confederate reenactors and people talking about Thomas's Legion. And then we also have a Union, which we have artillery, some cavalry, and infantry, and we'll be doing demonstrations about tactics, marching, and drilling.
For people who want more information, where can they go online?
You can go to our Facebook page, Sequoia Birthplace Museum, where we keep most everything rapidly posted there. And then you can visit our internet site, just Google Sequoia Birthplace Museum, and we get our information up there as well. And you can also call the museum, it's 423-884-6246.
All right, Charlie, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
What makes downtown Chattanooga special and unique? We're talking with people and businesses who will tell you how in a series of conversations we call We Are Downtown. in collaboration with River City Company. In this conversation, we hear from Sunshine Loveless, owner of Outshine Adventures.
Sunshine, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ray.
How did you find your way to Chattanooga?
That's kind of an interesting story. I played fast-pitch softball growing up. And in 1996, we made the national tournament at Warner Park. And I don't know why I felt drawn to the city and remember telling my parents, I want to live here someday. So when I was in my 20s, I wandered out to Chattanooga. I took a rafting trip on the Ocoee River and was immediately hooked. I asked the guide in the back if he got paid to do this, and he said yes. So I picked up an application and I was training to be a raft guide the next summer. I spent 6 years full time as a raft guide, trip leader, and trainer with Sunburst Adventures. And it was the best job I ever had. Eventually, I put my college degree to use, worked for the Department of Children's Services as a social worker. And all the while, I was playing women's full contact football with the Chattanooga Locomotion. So that's what held me here in my 20s and early 30s.
And then what makes Chattanooga special for you?
The Tennessee River that flows right through the heart of downtown. Obviously, I love water. I was drawn to become a raft guide. So yeah, it's the recreational opportunities that the Tennessee River provides right downtown. I also love the Tennessee Riverwalk for biking purposes that follows 16 miles along the Tennessee River from Chickamauga Dam to St. Elmo. So those are pretty unique features that a lot of other cities don't have. I love Coolidge Park and exploring, just relaxing and exploring in Coolidge Park with the views of the Tennessee River and walking over the Walnut Street Bridge. And then we have some great vegan restaurants. I'm personally a vegan, and I think Chattanooga is starting to become a pretty good pin on the map for good vegan food. But downtown is where I live, work, and play. So that's why I love it.
And what do you think is a hidden gem in Chattanooga, a hidden gem in downtown?
That's got to be Renaissance Park, mainly because everyone knows about Coolidge Park. That's the iconic park of downtown Chattanooga. And right next to it is Renaissance Park, which has really cool sculptures, walking paths, piers over the river, a cool cardboard hill. So there's just a lot of history right there in that area. And they did a really good job of offering placards and other information to make people aware that that exists. McClellan Island is also a hidden gem. You can only access it by watercraft. And Coolidge Park has not one, but two specific kayak launch points so that you can use a paddlecraft to get out to the island and explore that. It's managed by the Audubon Society and is a really nice sanctuary for birds in the middle of downtown.
What are a few ways people can enjoy Chattanooga like you?
Get out and explore by foot, by bike, by paddlecraft. Obviously, I love being outside, so that's what I'm going to encourage people to do. There's so many awesome outdoorsy things to do right in downtown Chattanooga. You can rent paddleboards from L2 and paddle around McClellan Island, like I just mentioned. You can rent a bike from Pedego, cruise around Coolidge Park, over the Walnut Street Bridge, and along the Tennessee Riverwalk. There's also the Bike Chattanooga, the Bike Share Program, which is a great way to get a bicycle if you don't have your own. You can grab lunch or dinner from Cashew, my favorite vegan restaurant right downtown. Eat it in the park or right there at their place. You should also definitely rent a mountain bike, or if you have your own, go over to Stringer's Ridge and carve out, shred on some single track, and then maybe catch the sunset from the overlook there. Then, of course, don't forget to go into town and get a nice craft beer from any one of our awesome local breweries. That would probably be my perfect day in Chattanooga.
All right. Sunshine, we'll see you out there. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Stay tuned for more conversations coming soon from We Are Downtown. For more information about River City Company, visit rivercitycompany.com. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.